Welcome to Heavy Potter's Heavy Cast, episode 127. That is...
still going.
127, that is.
How many... I've had a depressing thought. Just take the number of episodes and times it by the average length of this podcast.
Yeah.
And we've spent, like, at least a week, right, of our lives doing this.
Probably. Oh, speaking of, so I just Googled Tidal to see if there was any new news. the headline was, Tidal is investigating data breach that led to accusation of inflated streaming numbers.
Oh, sure. I bet they were wearing fingerless gloves. And they had like a copy of Neuromancer in the background when they were hacking into those servers.
And the listener has...
What's that line? Wait. What's that line from CSI? I'm building a visual basic GUI to track down the killer's IP.
Oh, yeah. No, I think that's NCIS. But no, the line from CSI is, yeah, as you put on the sunglasses.
I'll admit I did not get that until you explained it.
It's funny. With this episode, we're just going to talk about random stuff, I guess.
There's no news, guys. Like, there's no music.
There's a new Alkaloid album, but we've talked about it like five times already. Just fucking listen to it.
There's a new Backstreet Boys track.
Oh my god. Yeah, it's not great. I don't know.
It's not bad. It's not bad. It's just like... it's super generic.
Yeah, there's no reason for them to have, like, made an effort for this.
Do you think this is a response to the sick burn I got on them last week?
What was the burn? I remember when there I was said, a burn, but I don't remember what it was.
It's just not Justin Timberlake, the entire band.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. They listened to the podcast and they like whipped up a song and video in 1 week.
I only know the name of one guy there, Nick, right? I don't know which one he is. So, Nick, if you're listening.
Aaron?
Don't make more music.
Okay, now they're listening and... they're gonna stop. Aaron.
So what about
Aaron was in,
what about Tidal?
So yeah, they basically calling this a data breach. The PR they put out was, we reject and deny the claims that have been made by Dagens Næringsliv. That's the newspaper. Although we do not typically comment on stories we believe to be false, we feel it is important to make sure that our artists, employees, and subscribers know that we are not taking the security and integrity of our data lightly, and we will not back down from our commitment to them. So they're not denying any of the like fraud claims. They're just saying that, oh, this was a data breach. Like, well, this shouldn't happen again. It's always amazing when like something like this happens and they're like, they attack the way that the information leaked and not the, the bad
the
thing
contents
that the leak led to.
Yeah. I mean, in general, it's, you know, corporation PR 101, right? You're much bigger. And people want to believe you. Your users, you know, have an inherent bias to believe you. Yeah. So just go on the offensive and hope for the best.
Yeah, this changes the narrative from Tidal is committing fraud to there was a data breach at Tidal and they're doing their best to fix it.
Yeah. And by the way, that speaks a lot to how shitty our public discourse on tech has become, where data breaches is the lesser evil. And like, yeah, it's not as bad as fraud, but it's also not that great. Like,
I mean, it's
if
all,
there was,
it's also there's the like a data breach is like, not necessity is not the right word, but like it's a reality. Like, it's probably going to happen.
Yeah, but I do feel like, you know, it's become so normal and common that people don't care about it anymore.
Yeah,
and when stuff like that happens, no one asks. You know, the follow up question to this would be, well, why the fuck did you have a data breach? Like, okay, was it one of those inevitabilities, or did you set your admin password to 50s?
We were talking about this one time on the podcast, like years ago. There was this incident where somebody set their password to something like extremely basic, some service, like they got hacked because their password was like super basic. What was this?
There's the password to the atomic repository of the United States. Do you know this story?
No.
So JFK wanted... by the way, this is what you can expect from this episode.
There's something I want to circle back to, but okay, just tell the story.
So JFK, he wanted more security around our nuclear missiles, and especially to put in safeguards so that the military couldn't launch them instantaneously. And obviously the military and the Air Force, they didn't like that because they wanted to have, you know, their hand on the literal trigger.
Mm-hmm.
But they had to capitulate.
Hashtag triggered.
Jesus Christ. Is this H3H3? Oh. Is this what we've become?
I mean, you were literally just talking about them right before we started.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah. I love Ethan. He's so great. I don't feel betrayed in any way. Anyway, so they had to capitulate and they installed these locks on the missile silos. But they hated JFK and McNamara, the chief of defense or internal affairs or whatever you call it, secretary of whatever. They hated them so much that they said, okay, we'll put in the locks. But the second they left the base, they set it all to 10 zeros. And that was the password to unlock the Minutemen first response silos until 5 years ago.
Nice.
That was the password.
Wow.
Yeah. Makes you feel safe, doesn't it?
Yeah. It reminds me of the story of, you know, the Soviet submarine operator who got the order to nuke America and then was like...
The man who saved the world.
Yes.
Yeah.
Vasily Alexandrovich Arkhipov is his name, and the story is that basically this guy was a Soviet operative in 1962, and he was in a sub, like a Soviet sub, and he got the order to launch the nukes to the U.S. Basically, if I remember correctly, they had their own defense systems triggered a false positive, and he was told to, in retaliation, nuke America. And he hesitated. He second-guessed the order, and he held back. And turns out that it was a false positive. And, basically, his not following orders prevented, World War III or the nuclear apocalypse from happening.
Yep. So, thank you for listening to this episode of 99% Invisible. I don't know who those sponsors are. What is the common podcast sponsor? Casper Mattresses.
Yeah, I think it's Lisa Mattresses now. Casper was a few years ago.
I only listen to these days to the Beef and Dairy Network. Are you familiar with these guys? Dude, it's amazing. I think you love it. It's this British podcast that's supposedly companion podcast to industry newsletter for the beef and dairy industry.
What the fuck?
But then, super weird, Night Vale-ish Lovecraftian horror and occult.
Nice.
So, for example, there are the four meats, pork, chicken, beef, and what was the
human
last one? I don't remember. Lamb.
Okay.
And then there's the fifth meat. And you're not supposed to talk about it, and anybody who raises it gets assassinated by the government. It's a really funny and understated podcast, and they do ZipRecruiter, and they have a whole thing with their sponsorship. Go listen to it.
Nice.
It's really, really fun.
It reminds me of The Laundry Files by Charles Stross, which if you're not reading it, you're fucking up. But I think...
Yeah, it's on my list.
I think I mentioned this on the podcast before. Basically, it's Lovecraftian urban sci-fi fantasy. Basically, the Laundry Files is a covert government organization started around World War II, where they realized that basically solving complex mathematical equations leads to magic, essentially. And they also retroactively justify magic in earlier history with this. Basically, if you're solving, and Alan Turing basically was the lead up to this. And by solving complex mathematical equations in your head, you can make magic. But what this does is it also opens up your mind to eldritch influences. And if you do too much of this, you just go insane. So you have to either use computational devices to do this or use some other sort of safeguard. So what happens is if some sort of math PhD guy accidentally discovers a theorem that is a portal to a hell dimension, they essentially force recruit these people into their organization because you can't kill them and they're useful, so you want to utilize them, but you basically lock them down in bureaucracy. And the story is of a computer scientist / mathematician guy who's totally doesn't want to be pulled into this, but he gets pulled into it anyway. And he keeps rising up in the ranks in the organization because of organizational ineptitude. Like, it's very British in terms of, like, how much they hate.
He fails upward.
Yes. Well, the organization fails, and he just kind of gets pushed upward as a result. it's really nice. It's pretty self-aware, but not, like, super ironically so. It's just really good sci-fi. It takes place in the current day, and it's overarching. So, basically, it deals with this idea that as, you know, the computational power of the world increases and, like, the field of mathematics progresses, more and more people are going to start to, like, accidentally uncover these, like, dangerous theorems. And that's going to lead to, like, a buildup of eldritch power in the world, which is eventually going to lead to an apocalypse of, like, the Elder Ones, like, invading our world. And this is them trying to mitigate that and deal with it. But also, you know, the day-to-day stuff of, like, elder vampires attacking their base and trying to destroy them, dealing with the Deep Ones, dealing with all kinds of stuff. It's a really cool series. It first started off as, like, a couple of short stories, so the first book is, like, a collection of short stories, but then he decided to turn it into a series, and it's super great.
That sounds amazing. So you wanted to circle back to something?
Yes.
Or are we doing, like, a book episode?
Yeah, I'm circling back. The yeah reference, like the CSI thing, comes from I've been watching the fourth season of iZombie. It's a CW TV show, and the premise is it's based on a comic, very loosely based on a comic book series. But basically, there are zombies, and when you eat the brain of someone, you recover their memories and personality. So what happens is our main character, she used to be a doctor, but she accidentally becomes a zombie and, like, it kind of ruins her life. And she becomes a medical examiner at a police morgue. And this is her gateway to, like, obtaining food, right? But she realizes that she can help solve cases because, like, whenever there's a murder, she can eat the murdered person's brain and basically help uncover the murder. So she masquerades as a psychic and partners with this detective, and they start solving crimes. And it starts off as, like, a pretty, like, ironic, whimsical. It's made by people who worked on what's that famous TV show with Kristen Bell in the lead?
True Blood?
No. Veronica Mars.
Oh yeah.
It's made by the people who made that, so it has that very same, like, whimsical, self-aware tone. And it starts to, like, get more and more interesting as, like, more zombies start coming up, and like, the villain character is really great. If you see him, you'll recognize him. I'm trying to find the name of the actor, and, like, this starts to build a overarching plot. David Anders is the name of the guy who plays the villain, but he's, like, he's, like, the lovable, like, villain slash sometimes works with the good guys, you know, that type of, like, Buffy like vibe, right?
Yeah.
And it starts building
Nathan Fillion, basically.
Yeah. It builds into this, like, really nice overarching narrative. And then the fourth season, spoilers, I guess, but, like, like, zombies go public and they take over Seattle, which is where the show takes place, by the way. And, like, they instate martial law. And it's like, become very political and very interesting. It's, like, a super cool show. And the Yeah references from, they have this one episode that is, like, extra self-aware. They do things like, one character says, they're watching, like, there's this in-universe zombie show that they're called Zombie High, which is, like, a high school rom drama show in the universe. And they're saying, like, oh yeah, the fourth season of that sucks. Like, that's where they run out of money. And instead of, like, showing cool things, they, like, just have characters talk about them. And as he's saying, the detective walks in and, like, talks about this really exciting, like, chase that they had. And how he caught a suspect and, like, he had to, like, jump off a building and all that kinds of stuff. But also, at one point, the main character, she like, does a mic drop moment and, like, puts on her glasses and walks away. And, like, somebody else, yeah, in the background. And, like, turns out, like, somebody, like, stubbed their toe and they just walk. It's very funny. I don't do it justice. But, like, this show is fucking amazing. It's also kind of has, like, that Pushing Daisies type of vibe that I think you would really like it too.
Yeah, I love Pushing Daisies.
So, yeah, definitely check out iZombie. It's a really amazing show. Like, it's a really good time. It's really funny and also, like, really clever. So, and the characters are all adorable. Like, it's just a feel-good show that's also, like, really interesting and a good time.
So, if we're doing, like, a random dynamic, that's the word I was looking for. A dynamic disruptive episode, very techie. Disruptive. Yeah, we're disrupting the podcast. And I'm just going to jump on, you know, one of the things you said and move from there. You mentioned it's based on a comic book.
Mm-hmm.
And we mentioned a lot of comic books, but we haven't mentioned any in a while. And I've been reading a bit less because I'm reading more books and playing video games. So comics kind of took a backseat.
Comics are for children. But I haven't... You're reading books
now. Oh, yeah. Yeah, more mature, like bands who become boring. I don't do harsh vocals anymore. And I have like those thin synths and I force myself to go for notes I can't reach. Anyway, I have been reading some stuff and I think the main thing I want to kind of shine a light on is not a specific book, but an artist who, by the way, works a lot with metal bands. She did art for Roadburn Festival. She did some art for Clutch and other artists and Becky Cloonan.
Hmm.
And Becky Cloonan is a really, really interesting, relatively young artist working within comics. She does a lot of stuff for Image, but also other publishers. And she has some really good stuff out there. So I'm looking at her, like, stuff that she's worked for. She worked with The Sword. She did a few tour posters. And she's really into metal. Like, that's why she works with festivals and metal bands, because she herself... really enjoys the music. So that's kind of the other tie-in. So some stuff I'd recommend reading by her. Currently, I'm just reading her Southern Cross series, and you will love this. There are two volumes out.
I'm fairly certain I've heard of this.
Yeah, so it's a pretty big deal right now. Like, she's made waves in the industry with this. It's like about a spaceship, and... It's interstellar, but it's unclear if it's the only interstellar ship or if it's super rare, but it does the interstellar travel thing with some sort of alien technology at its core.
Wait, I purchased the first volume of this. I just haven't read it yet. I just purchased it like a couple weeks ago on Comixology.
Cool. So read it. Okay. And the thing is, once they switch on this drive that uses this alien technology, it starts fucking with reality. You take all that and put into it like a noir murder detective on a train story, but the train is an interstellar spaceship, and you get something really cool. And the thing is, when I read the first volume, I liked it, but I was not convinced that it was more than just a one-hit wonder or one take. But now I've read the second volume, and it's super interesting. Instead of keeping it on a ship, it moves to like a rig on Titan, and they mine some ore from there, and it keeps the general noir kind of vibe, but digs deeper into the lore and the weirdness and all that stuff. I really, really recommend it. And she's also worked on other really interesting stuff. She's worked on Demo with Brian Wood, who's one of my all-time favorite writers, and Demo specifically is like short stories of people experiencing weird quasi-supernatural things. It's super good. She worked with him on Channel Zero, which was one of the first things that he published. She has a really broad style. And she also does like DC and Marvel, like more, you know, traditional kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
She's worked on New Avengers and Punisher and Young Avengers and Batman and Harley Quinn and Swamp Thing and a bunch of other things. She's also had a run on Northlanders. That's Brian Wood's Viking series, which you should 100% read. It's amazing. And yeah, Becky Cloonan in general is a name you might want to keep in your thoughts. She's a rising star in the world of comics.
Cool.
Yeah. Have you gotten a chance to read any comics lately? We haven't spoken about it.
I've read a bunch of manga.
Which?
So I'm right now reading. Nijigahara Holograph by Inio Asano. Inio Asano is known for a lot of things, but I think the most well-known thing is Good Night Punpun, Oyasumi Punpun.
Yeah, I know the name.
It's messed up and depressing, as a lot of stuff that Inio Asano writes. And there seems to be like a supernatural... It's like, so what I like about his works is that him, actually don't know if Inio-san is a guy or not. I just want to look this up now. It's a guy. Okay. So the premise of Nijigahara Holograph is that it's so okay. I want to talk about a general vibe, and this is going to tie into the next thing I'm going to talk about. It has a Lynchian vibe, and it has this vibe of like the story itself doesn't really matter. It's the moment to moment.
Interesting.
So let me just read you the synopsis of this, because I don't want to, like, it's hard to capture. And butterflies ominously proliferate as children whisper rumors of a mysterious creature lurking in the tunnel behind the school. To appease its wrath, they decide to offer it a sacrifice, a human one. But this is only the beginning, which takes place in of Nijigahara Holograph, which takes place in two separate timelines and involves the suicidal Amaiko, Kota, the love-struck bully, their teacher, whose heavily bandaged face remains a mystery, and many more brothers, sisters, parents, co-workers, teachers, aggressors, and victims who are all inextricably linked to one another. 10 years later, all will have to face what they've done or suffer through, and maybe the end of the world.
Interesting.
So, but yeah, the thing is, like, it's very Lynchian in that it doesn't feel like it's going to resolve the plot. It just feels like about the moment-to-moment unsettlingness and the feeling. Like, and I really like that vibe. I feel like not a lot of stuff captures that these days. Like, I feel like that's kind of a style that's not as in vogue anymore. But Inio Asano is really good at it. And like Oyasumi Ponpon also did that. Some of Junji Ito's stuff does that, but like with a more obvious horror tint. And so this is definitely very messed up and very interesting. So if you're into like Lynchian things and this premise sounds intriguing to you, I would recommend checking it out. It's a single volume, like 300 page hardcover. So yeah, you can find it on, like,
it's pretty long.
You can find it on, you know, whatever, Amazon or whatever. So the reason I bring up Lynchian is after Nick's recommendation, I started watching Atlanta, Donald Glover's show. Yeah, it's fantastic. I really love it.
It is fantastic.
I finished the first season and I'm like 3 episodes into the second season. So I haven't gotten to the like breaking point Nick mentioned yet. But yeah, it definitely feels Lynchian in a way. And that, again, like things happen. Like there's the shooting. There's like Van getting fired, and like they're like events happen that would be like major life-changing events, but they're never really like tied to anything. It just kind of happens and is in the backdrop, and there's like some weirdness going on in the backdrop, but it's all about like the moment to moment feeling and unsettling thing. It's a really interesting vibe. It's really fascinating.
It feels like a fever dream. Yeah. Right? It feels like the characters are kind of in a daze. And there are many ways to read it. Like, one of my favorite ones is saying, you know, this is what living on the edge of a society looks like. Mm-hmm. Right? You're not sure where the next meal is coming from. You're not sure if you're going to have a job or not. You're not sure if, you know, the woman you love, do you love her? You have a kid together. How does that work? And you're constantly moving from one thing to another, just trying to survive, basically. Mm-hmm. And it puts you into this kind of like daze. It's been said, you know, Donald Glover's performance in the show is very detached.
Yeah.
It's very aloof. So people are kind of talking about how the character itself is desensitized to all the stuff that's going on around it, which is an interesting take. You can also take it into the, and you wouldn't be exaggerating because Glover is known for dealing in this kind of stuff. You know, this is just weird art, right? Mm-hmm. It's just trying to freak you out in like a very subtle and abstract way. It does a good job doing that, I feel. Mm-hmm.
And similar to like Nijigahara Holograph, is that it's not just the weird stuff, but it also like if you look at it from the moment to moment, everything makes sense, right? Like the character interactions make sense, like the momentary narrative makes sense. But overall, it's has this vibe of detachment. So it's not sacrificing one for the other, which is hard to do.
Yeah, that's the balancing act, right? And I feel like I'm watching the second season of Santa Clarita Diet.
Mm-hmm. Oh man, love it.
And that's also a show that does that really well. Like, I can't believe that I'm not cringing when they talk about, you know, the morality and how to be a good parent and life advice, but they do it so well. Like, they tie it so well into, and you never know which way they're going to go. And this is something that you talk about a lot with Japanese media, tonal imbalance, but on purpose, right? Jumping between super serious and super funny and super weird and keeping you on your toes. I feel like the series does that really, really well.
Definitely.
Like, you never know the next sentence. Is the next sentence going to be serious? Is it going to be funny? Is it going to be horror? Is it going to be weird? They do that kind of balance really, really well. And it's even better than the first season.
Definitely.
And they do a really good job of, I won't spoil anything because I genuinely want people to see the show, like introducing the grander lore around everything that's going on, but really, really slowly, so it doesn't feel artificial. And the last thing, I just love Eric so much. I love the actor.
Oh, yeah.
I love
so
the character.
Good.
He's just so funny, and he's also just a really good comedic actor. He has impeccable sense of timing.
Mm-hmm.
And I never knew that Oliphant was such a physical, a great physical actor.
Yeah.
Like the episode with the tango where he like contorts his body into all these positions. He's so good. Like, literally every person on this show is super good at what they do. And it's a really cool show, and it's fun to watch it. It kind of breezes by. What I like is that there's a lot less gore this season. Like, they kind of realize that, okay, like, we've done the premise of shocking people with gore. We'll do it once in a while because it's still a zombie thing. But it's a lot less that and a lot more character development and what are the ramifications of the situation that the characters find themselves in. It's super good. I'm really enjoying it. We're really close to the end of the season.
And, like, it's really amazing how, like, they turn, like, lampshading inside out because, like...
Yeah, like, it's when you look at it, like, objectively, let's say you somehow, you know, like a Chinese room thing, they fed the images of the show, but without the context into your brain, you'd say it was trash.
Yeah.
It's trash. It's super trashy. Like, if you just look at the bare facts, but when you experience the show and it reels you in into the way that it approaches things, it's just marvelous. It turns this really trashy thing into a really clever, take on storytelling and comedy and why things make us laugh, I feel. It's super cool. I'm really enjoying it. And like the complete other end of the spectrum, we finished the second season of Broadchurch.
Wait, before you move on from Santa Clarita, I just want to, like, the Joel McHale cameo in this season is amazing. And like the whole fucking realtor thing, like, you got there, right?
That entire, like, the Chris and Krista thing is just fantastic. And again, it's, those jokes are stupid. They're fucking dumb, but the way they are handled and delivered, and then referenced again and again, how it goes back and forth with its lampshading, like, internal comedy, is just impeccable. You know what it obviously reminds me of Better Off Ted, which is, you know, it's the same people. That's exactly what made Better Off Ted so good. It was a terrible, stupid show, but the internal mechanics just worked so well. And now that they've brought, what's his name? The guy who played Phil. Now he's the guy in the asylum. So the guy who played one of the scientists in Better Off Dead, he plays the guy in the asylum that Joel confides in.
Oh, yeah, that guy. Yeah, yeah.
So now I want him to bring back his counterpart, the other scientist from Better Off Dead. You know, the geeky one with the glasses.
Yeah.
And the bow ties and all that. I love that guy. So I'm looking forward to his cameo. And it feels like they're going through the checklist of all actors who appeared on Better Off Ted. Just bringing
them. And they're making good use of Nathan Fillion too.
Nathan Fillion is a great cast. It's just so good. It's really fun. Go watch it.
iZombie again, like, is kind of like that, less extreme than Santa Clarita Diet, but like it has the similar vibe. So I think, like, if you're looking for a less quirky, slightly less quirky, but more kind of mystery-driven version of that, I would definitely recommend iZombie. I think you should put that on the list.
Yeah, I'm going to put that on my list. That sounds great. So, we finished the second season of Broadchurch. Yeah. And it's like, the polar opposite, because this is a series that chooses one tone and just bludgeons you in the face with it. And the first season, and I owe you a great debt because you're the one who told me to like watch it. It's a masterpiece.
Yes.
It's so amazing. And also Ronnie. Ronnie's berating me. It was also Ronnie who told me, but Noyan also insisted that I watch it. There's like the room that I'm in has a little window into the living room so she can peek in and berate me. The second season is not as good as the first one, but that's like saying that this dish that you have is not as good as a 3-star Michelin restaurant, right? It's still fucking incredible. It's, again, I think the main virtue of this show is the acting. The acting is just impeccable. David Tennant really steps up, even better than his usual performance. I won't spoil anything, but near the end of the season, you know, where his situation worsens, like his physical acting, the shaking, the anxiety attacks, so good. And every single person on the cast just nails it. Unlike the first season's strength, you know, it's one of those, like a book series where the first one, you can tell that it was planned for 10 years. And then the other ones were like kind of more hastily written. Same thing here. Like the first season is super tight. And the second one, the beats don't come as often or as powerful. But when they land, it's just amazing. And the new characters are so good. Jocelyn, the lawyer, she's amazing. What's her opponent's name? I don't remember. Like her ex, student pupil. Yeah, you've watched it like ages ago.
Yeah.
Really, really well done. I am in awe. I can't wait to start the third season. I had a super great time. It's just recommended to anybody who likes, you know, British crime drama, really melancholic and sad stuff. You gotta watch this. It's so
good. Small town, like eerie vibes, crime drama. And it's interesting because now Chris Chibnall, the showrunner for Broadchurch, and Jodie Whittaker, who plays the wife, they're so Doctor Who. Now the new actress for Doctor Who is Jodie Whittaker.
Yes.
And Chris Chibnall is the new showrunner for Doctor Who. So I'm really interested in seeing where they go with that.
That's, you know, that's the kind of stuff that you get only in British TV because the roster is so much smaller. Like, I don't remember the actress's name. I love her. She plays Miller. She's a comedy actress. Like, I know her from...
Olivia Colman?
Yes, I know her from, you know, the Mitchell and Webb show. Like, she's on there all the time.
She was on Hot Fuzz.
Yeah, she was on Hot Fuzz. Like, she's a comedic actress, but then I see her here, and it's like, holy shit, she's so good. Especially in the second season, she gets a lot more screen time, like a lot more impactful scenes, and she really does her work very, very well.
She was also in The Lobster, which is, if you haven't seen that, just, like, go fucking watch The Lobster.
Was she?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't recognize her. That's weird.
Yeah.
I saw it. Maybe, you know, it was during a festival, so I should rewatch that. Like, I watched a million films.
The Lobster is super advanced.
Yeah, it's super advanced.
She's the,
it's Jordan Peterson's favorite movie.
Oh, my fucking God. She's the manager of the hotel.
Yeah. No, now that you say it, it's like clicks. I just didn't associate her.
Yeah.
I should rewatch that. Broadchurch, go watch it. It's great.
So another instance of the British scene being super incestuous. The guy playing the Reverend in Broadchurch used to be the companion of the Doctor in season 5.
Oh, yeah. Huh. Interesting.
Now
he keeps reminding me. They look nothing alike. They're just both... Yeah, they have ginger hair. He reminds me of Domhnall.
Yeah, kind of.
He also plays in that British scene, so...
And he now is in Legends of Tomorrow, which is, like, fucking silly-ass cheese, but he's, like... He basically plays Doctor Who in that show, which is, like, extremely self-aware.
That's amusing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Maybe last thing for me before we wrap up. I finished God of War.
Oh, nice.
Like... Yeah. 2 hours ago, 3 hours ago. Wow. It's so good. Like, I wouldn't put it, it's not as good as The Last of Us, which is my all-time favorite game, but also a game which God of War really takes a lot from. like the kind of semi-open world kind of vibe and the dynamic between an adult and the kid and the way the story unfolds and stuff like that. But that's where the comparison ends, because then there's like Dark Souls-like combat and shit like that. It's not as good. Some of the game mechanics are kind of clunky. And I definitely got really overpowered before I did the main game, like the main storyline. So some of it gets repetitive and kind of underwhelming, but the story just makes up for any small glitch that you might have. It's so powerful. It's so well written, and it's fucking God of War. Like it, the series has one of the shittiest stories ever written, before this, and it references all that stuff and actually fixes it, right? It like reframes it.
Yeah.
Looks at it again and says, yeah, okay, it was super over the top and like he becomes a god 15,000 times and kills everybody. But if you look at it like a mythology, if you look at it like a story, here are the lessons that it tells and here's the growth that we're going to get from that. So it's pretty obvious that there's going to be a DLC, right?
I think they're not planning DLC, but
Yeah,
they've, I guess, I mean, they can do it, but they just haven't like...
Yeah, I mean, Naughty Dog said they'll never do Last of Us 2, and that's happening, yeah. So. They just left huge parts of the world unexplored, like Vanaheim and Asgard, you just don't go there.
So they have plans laid out for up to 5 games in this iteration of God of War, so that might also just be like left out for the sequels.
Yeah, cool. So, yeah, I really enjoyed it. The issues that I had were minor, and honestly, the game is just so cool that even the boring fights and stuff like that is still awesome. And some of it is super challenging.
Yeah.
I played on the hardest difficulty, well, the second hardest difficulty, and some of the fights were like...
The Valkyries. You know,
I'm not a Dark Souls player. The Valkyries. Some of the actual bosses in the story are pretty easy. Mm-hmm. Like the trolls are, at some point, just meaningless because you do so much damage. But the Valkyries are super hard. I haven't done all of them. I've done like 4, and I've only done like the first few levels of the Muspelheim challenges, which are also, they're also supposed to be really difficult. It's a good game, guys. It's just awesome. Yeah, just go play it.
Speaking of games, I have a couple things that I want to mention. So I got
Beat
Saber. Are you aware of Beat Saber?
What's that?
It's a VR game.
No?
That's on Oculus and Vive. So what this is it's kind of like Audio Surf, but it's it's on like pre-made tracks. So it's, I guess in that sense, it's more like Guitar Hero. So like it doesn't like take your music and do anything with it yet. But basically, you have 2 lightsabers, right, in one hand each, and blocks come at you. If you just look at a screenshot of it, it'll be very obvious. Blocks come at you, and they're either blue or red, and like one hand has a blue saber, the other hand is a red saber, so you have to hit them with the correct saber. But also, blocks have direction markers on them, so you have to hit them like to the right or to the bottom. Like, cut them, basically, right? Mm. Slice them open upwards, downwards, rightwards, leftwards. And
interesting.
There's also like obstacles coming at you that you have to dodge with your head. But it's like... incredibly satisfying to play. Like, it has that Tetris syndrome of like, you know, when you play like too much Tetris, you start seeing it in your dreams. It's like has some really good techno music, and it's like super like hitting these notes in time like is incredibly satisfying. I've never been this satisfied playing a rhythm game before. Like, it's super, and it's also on PSVR, by the way, my bad. But the advantage of getting it on PC is there's a pretty active modding scene. So they put, like, songs, like, they created more songs for it. So there's, like, Through the Fire and the Flames. I tried that. It's super fucking difficult. So I had to turn on, like, no fail mode to do it because it's really challenging. There's, like, meme songs. There's Linkin Park. There's some K-pop. There's Avenged Sevenfold. It's really, really fucking good. Like, if you have a VR headset, fucking get Beat Saber. It's amazing. It's like, and it's a good workout too. And the developers have said that they are going to add like official level editing support as well. But like right now, the modding community is doing a great job. So that's super great. And like I said, just look up footage. And so there's this new like platform called live.it. And what that does is it lets you stream your VR games. But like normally, you know, streaming VR is pretty awkward because it just like mirrors what you see in the headset. But that's not a good representation. But with this plugin, you can essentially like stream the environment. And I'm sending you a screenshot of it in that. So that like basically, it's like in third person, and your environment in VR is rendered as well. So it's actually like really entertaining to watch.
That's really cool.
So like, you can go check out footage of this game then. And like, basically what was going on was, I've been hearing about Beat Saber, but I was like, seems like maybe I'll get to it one day. But then I watched someone playing Through the Fire and Flames in it, in this mode. And I was like, fuck, I need to get this right now. And then I got it and I played it for like an hour straight, and I was like completely covered in sweat, but it was amazing. So another VR game that I'm playing is Silento, which I guess is like the Japanization of the word silent, but this is a first person arena shooter, kind of. Basically, it's like cool ass shit. You have katanas, you have dual pistols and like other dual weapons, and you can like, there's bullet time. You could like jump, dodge, walk on walls, do flips in the air, teleport around. It's just basically like a amazing power fantasy. It's really, really fun. It's also pretty disorienting to play at first, because like when you do like jump towards a wall, flip in the air and you're shooting, you're like upside down and like you're shooting people in the air in bullet time. But it's like incredibly satisfying. And also very tiring, like mentally tiring. Like Beat Saber is actually physically tiring, because like you're making super fast moves. Yeah. This one's like,
yeah,
mental overload, but it's super fun. Like you just like dash, slice people up. Like,
yeah, that sounds awesome.
It's fucking amazing. So yeah, if you have a VR platform, go check out Beat Saber and Silento. And like, they're like fairly cheap. They're like $10-$15 or something like that, if I remember correctly. So like, that's one nice thing about VR games, is that they're usually like pretty decently priced and you get a lot of value out of them. Also, based on Simon's recommendation, I checked out Slay the Spire. Do you know what this is?
Yeah, deck building game.
Yeah, right? Roguelike deck building dungeon crawling game. And it's it's pretty nice. So the premise is that like there's this... not like a map, but like branching paths, and you at every step you kind of choose which way you want to go, and you can see like where it ends up in terms of like there's a monster, there's a treasure chest, there's a bonfire to rest at or whatever. And at each turn, you know, you combat enemies and you have a deck, so you have like, you take turns with the enemy and like you play cards. It's like a deck building ish turn-based game. I think it's really cool, but it is, I think it needs a lot more variety. I don't know if it's still in early access or if it came out. I was still in early access. Nice. So it's super fun. Like the mechanics are really nice, and it feels really satisfying to play. But I think there needs to be a lot more variety to the encounters and cards and enemies you get, because like you can run out of stuff pretty easily right now. But I think the game has a lot of potential. So yeah, go check it out if you're into that. And
yep.
One final thing. There's a new roguelike, and this one was a roguelike too, by the way. I really like roguelikes. Called, what was it, Wizard of Legend?
Okay.
And this one is on consoles and Switch as well. This is top-down, beat-em-up style. Basically, you're like a wizard. You have like four abilities. There's like a dash. There's a like elemental, and you can like, there's tons of abilities in the game that you can acquire. Basically, like you go into the dungeon, like the typical setup, like it's similar to like Enter the Gungeon, I guess. But it's like a melee spell brawler style, and you can play it in co-op as well. Mm. It's really nice. Like it's pretty challenging, and there's so many different abilities. The art style is a pretty decent pixel style. Like it's not amazing, but it's pretty cool. And the abilities are like incredibly varied, and you can like combine different elemental / non-elemental abilities. Like there's a combo system. It's really satisfying to play. Like it's very snappy and fast paced. I guess like Enter the Gungeon is the closest I can think of this, yeah. But like if you watch like even like this, go to the Steam page and watch the GIFs, like it's very fast paced, and like you're calling in like blizzards and like shooting fireballs and like creating like wind cyclones and like dashing around. Like it's very fast paced and very like based on like feeling cool, right? So it's nice. And I'm not gonna like keep this going on and on, but Dead Cells is coming out in like a couple of months finally.
Dead Cells is so good.
It's going out of early access soon, and it's coming to like consoles and whatever as well. Fucking it, Dead Cells is beautiful. It's it's really challenging. It's really well made. Like, it's a roguelike Metroidvania that actually feels like it has designed levels. Like, the generation is incredible, and the enemies are amazing. It's super good.
Yep, even I like it, and roguelike is not like my... And Metroidvania is not my preferred genre, but Dead Cells is just done so, so well. You should check it out if you even have the slightest bit of interest in this kind of game. It's just super, super good.
Yep. All right.
Cool.
Cool.
Thank you for listening to whatever this was. Yeah. Oh, no, sorry. Dynamic
Disruptive.
Episode. Disruptive. Please subscribe, regram, retweet.
Post about it on BuzzFeed comments.
Oh, please actually do that. By the way, have you seen the latest internet comment etiquette?
I need to watch that. It's on my
queue. I really need to get... he has a shirt where it's like the Illuminati symbol and it says "Cease your investigations." I need that shirt. It's just...
Yes, we've mentioned this before. You need to watch Internet Comment Etiquette with Eric on YouTube. It's one of the best channels. It's super advanced.
Just hit random. Does YouTube have a random feature even?
No, I don't think so.
No. Well, fuck that. Bye. Wrap around and gather.